This episode of The Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 13th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 83rd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. I'm in New York with the rest of the art world this week, who've descended on the city for the second edition of Freeze Big Apple style. We'll be hearing what the art market and I have been up to over the past few days.
We look at our database and find out who's in New York, and we find out what they are interested in seeing, and we bring it to their doorstep.
Then we'll hop over to Toronto to get a guide to the city's music scene, courtesy of Gilbert Masuda.
A lot of people don't know that there's a really great burgeoning scene right now coming out of Toronto, which is sort of more on an electro soul tip and an instrumental beat tip.
And we'll head home to the UK to get a session from soul synth sensations Gentry and muse about the world's largest philosophy festival, which kicks off next week.
We've got a really fascinating theme this year, and our theme this year is called Error, Lies and Adventure. The idea is that it is through identifying errors that we find new adventures.
Plus, the recent Hey Beirut Forum explored freedom of expression in the Middle East. But is that all there is to it? We'll be asking all the best questions on that very topic right here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So first up, before we hear what's been going down in New York, we'll have Gentry, aka Rob Gentry, a man who can sometimes be found covered in glitter, always around a keyboard or a guitar or a range of other instruments he seems to have mastered. He's a disco virtuoso, a man with rhythm, style, melodies, and the capacity to reach notes only the under 25s can hear. He stopped by Midori House recently and perked us up at the end of our day, wowing us with his keyboard playing, and this, from his session, is such a good feeling. Take it away.
It started softly, as it does, but did some questions, they now appear, and they grow louder, just so much louder, and my conviction is no longer here. Coming clear, and they cut deeper, just so much deeper, and my composure is replaced with fear. Won't leave me now. Oh, I wish that I could run. Ooh, but I don't know how. Surrounding me, the silence grows. And closing me, my judgment goes.
Woo!
That was Gentry with Such a Good Feeling, which is what I hope you have right now. There'll be more from him, of course, and their uplifting tunes later on in the show. We're in New York City at the end of last week, progressing stately as a galleon up the East River. We're getting the ferry at 35th Street, and now the water's bubbling. Behind us, Manhattan proud on the left bank, Brooklyn's lower rise kissing the right. Under the 59th Street Bridge we duck, past Roosevelt Island we sail, and then we're there, Randall's Island with a large white appendage erected upon it. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, it's Frieze New York's big tent of contemporary art in town for 5 days. Not quite the plucky little Brit that could, more like the home under canvas of 180 art galleries from all over the world, showing and selling paintings, sculpture, installations, interventions, videos, performances, and champagne. The august London Art Fair sailed its barge and pitched its tent in New York City for the first time last year. So this year, is it new and improved? Matthew Slotover is the fair's co-director.
We try to make a fun and lively experience for visitors and for the galleries. The key design element was the curve of the tent. That's very unusual. Most buildings and fairs are rectilinear and have right angles everywhere. And we found last year that really affected people's experience of viewing the art. That the journey through the fair means you're sort of looking at art all the time rather than looking down an endless corridor. And it means there's a sort of surprise around every corner. Predominantly, it's a trade fair and the galleries need to sell the work. It's an active market. That side of it has to work. And we actually do whatever we can to make that side of it work. Part of doing that is to attract people to come. And people want to come because they want to have a nice time. You know, people are not buying art as part of their job. It's part of their leisure activity. Making it a fun, lively, novel experience every time, an event experience, is very important. We have two sections which focus on younger artists. One is Frame and one is Focus. Frame is the one with solo projects for galleries under 6 years old. Focus is, I think, up to three artists or a sort of curated booth for galleries up to 10 years old. And they both bring a kind of energy and a kind of life to the fair. You know, we're lucky enough in art fairs to be able to attract more people than a gallery would generally have visit. And for some people, it's one of the two or three art events they do all year, along with a big museum show, for instance. And we're conscious of that. And, you know, we're hoping that some of them are here just to look at the art and to learn about art and to engage with it. But that some of them here might be to buy for the first time as well.
All those collectors are one thing then, we'll come back to sales in a little while, but that element of discovery and curatorial instinct is important too. One wonderful exponent exhibiting under the Frame section of the fair was Auckland's Hopkinson Cundy Gallery, showing strange architectural work by Fiona Connor. Exercise bars, a towel caddy, over-engineered little outbuildings for the leisure industry, culled from a trip to a Baja beachside health spa. These pieces feel sort of out of place here, and that's largely the point. This is Sarah Hopkinson from Hopkinson Cundy.
We work with quite a small group of artists. A lot of them are based overseas. Frieze is just a great way for us to come and make a presentation on this side of the States. And I think these objects are very strange to encounter, and they sort of wanted to heighten that by making it, you almost sort of stumble across them, which I like. So much of Fiona's work is about how the space conditions our perception of an object, and I think in this case they feel very strange here because even though they're quite familiar objects, somehow they seem quite out of place in the fair, so it's quite nice that they're also like a little bit aggressive in space. I think that's what the Frame section is designed for. It's designed for us to basically introduce an artist to this huge audience. And yeah, I think you want to do that in the most interesting way possible. Fiona really likes the idea that when they come into the gallery or the art fair, they become just that next level of functionless.
Yes, you could say that it's all functionless, wonderfully useless. Another series of works that acted and reacted to the fair's atmosphere was Matteo Ternat's benches dotted around the tent, offering a seat to weary travellers, but their colour scheme suggested something else. Matteo also employed a couple of sad-looking actors to hold the fort, making for a strangely uncomfortable stop-off.
I looked at images of the fair from last year, and I noticed they had these kind of circular benches. So I figured it might be fun to kind of just riff off those. And invariably, someone needs to sit somewhere. So I kind of thought it might be nice to provide that. But then also, if they were a sculpture, they might second guess and kind of intellectually you may think it was interesting, but then their body was not sure. So there might be a little bit of a disconnect between whether if it was appropriate or inappropriate. And then once they sat, they were possibly doing something wrong. I chose the benches, and then I sort of thought like the fair usually has like color codes and things like that. I was already doing a lot of research on color theory, some sort of banal like Albers, and then some of it really fascinating like Wittgenstein or Goethe or something like that. I kind of read a bunch and then started to write these texts, and like the more I wrote, the more I realized you could basically say anything you want about color. And that each color sort of, you know, demarcates certain things for some people, but then some culturally for others. Like, you know, a stop sign in Nairobi might be blue, but in America it's red. It was a way of sort of like breaking them up, and I got really playful with the shapes. So each one was a different shape, and they sort of became theatrical props. But in a weird way, like in cinema, like a prop is something you touch, and if you don't touch it, it remains scenery. So I sort of thought like it was nice, it could be in between the two. One moment a prop, if you touch it, or if you don't sit on it, it remains just scenery like everything else.
So from the Not For Sale Frieze project to the fair proper, the gallery is coming to break new artists, sure, but here to do what they also call engaging with a new collector base, or selling paintings, if that's easier. I spoke to the frankly jolly Rebecca May Marston, director of London's Limoncello Gallery, to find out how they decide what to bring and show.
Different fairs, different things. For Frieze, it costs so much to come here, the booth's really expensive. It's a mixture of wanting to bring work that we think is going to appeal and is going to sell, and wanting to put works together that are going to kill it. We want the booths to stand out, and we thought a way to do it at this fair in particular was to not have much work on the booth. So last year we painted our booth brown. We were going for a Mad Men style office. Last year we were the only gallery to paint our booth. This year there are eight. I feel like all the kinks from last year have completely been ironed out. I mean, to me, on the first day, it was tumbleweed last year, and it was such good fun yesterday. There were loads of people, we chatted to loads of people. It was really, really great. The rain was a bummer, but it's a tent.
Yeah, it's a tent. Limoncello did well with their subtle spare booth, but people buy work in London all the time. What about a gallery from Beijing, a city of wealth but with a less established art market? How important is Frieze New York as a shop window for a gallery in a place where fewer people visit? And how important is it to show works representative of a Chinese gallery, not a Chelsea one? Teresa Liang is director of Beijing's Long March Space.
It is definitely a more relaxed fair. People are taking their time and they're not rushing. And especially in New York, it's probably slightly different to London as well, as Regent's Park is, you know, central London, while here it's really not the middle of nowhere, but it's outside of Manhattan, and it's in an island that generally nobody comes to. So it probably also gives more of a sense of a day out. You know, we look at our database and find out who's in New York, and we find out what they are interested in seeing, and we bring it to their doorstep. Parts of it is based on that, because, yeah, we need to have some form of certainty. It's important for us to also promote the artist that's not really known here. It's more fun to bring the kind of works that we cannot predict. However, you know, in the end, it's not really a lot of fun when, you know, when the sales is not good. So, yeah, we try to keep a balance, and, yeah. As international as people might think contemporary art is, it's not really there yet. If we compare contemporary art to fashion, for example, which is personally, I think, why it's so interesting, because it would be pretty boring if the kind of stuff that we bring looks exactly the same as Chelsea-based gallery.
The fairs are a vital part of a gallery's year in sales, but what about a gallery showing at a fair in its hometown? If you've invested in some nice real estate downtown in Chelsea, do you need to pitch a tent too? According to Catherine Erdman, co-director of New York's 303 Gallery, oh yes.
Right now at the gallery, we have an exquisite exhibition by Rodney Graham. They're new light boxes inspired by 19th century painting. One of the pieces is called The Drywaller, and it's a large-scale light box. Rodney's kind of on stilts in an unfinished room smoking a cigarette listening to a boombox. We have a study for that piece here in the booth, actually. Is just the boombox. So it's kind of a nice relation to the exhibition at the gallery and to the fair. And as far as the art fair goes, we're always trying to choose, you know, really new, fresh pieces from each artist, kind of make a nice example of each artist's practice and what they're showing and what they're working on right now. Frieze Art Fair is an international platform for some of the best, you know, curators, writers, collectors, you know, everyone around the world comes. It's a beautiful fair here on Randall's Island. It's a really nice kind of shop window platform to show brand new artwork by our artists. And it brings people into New York City. Everyone is here this weekend to see the fair, so we get a lot more visitors than we usually would on another weekend. So, yeah, we try to really curate some nice exhibitions at the gallery.
So it's business and pleasure at Frieze New York. Sales abound while visitors and collectors are reminded of the art world's rougher edges, with some of the more challenging and playful interventions along the way. But how do you get people coming back? You look after them, of course. Teresa Liang again.
Frieze takes care of galleries who show here and also the visitors, either VIPs or non-VIPs, because they bring in gourmet food, they bring in the best coffee shops, the best whatever, and they always do that, and I think that's their identity now.
So you could call it return business, you could call them happy customers, the galleries and the collectors, the foodies, the hacks, the odd and the amusing art world limpets that cling to the hull of the ship at these things. Fairs used to be big shops, but now, perhaps, with Frieze leading the way, they represent a truly international window into the state of contemporary art. Trends, emerging talent, new markets, conversations, and sure, what's selling? As the workmen take down the big top and stow the tent pegs until Frieze in London in October, in New York we've seen wonders, whimsy, and what the hell? And people ask if even New York can sustain two big contemporary art fairs, Frieze and the Armory Show. And you tend to answer, well, there's only one big one, really. It seems like Frieze could set their temporary structure in stone. Plus, people love the ride to Randall's Island. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and we set sail from New York next and head to Toronto.
In a region typified by change, Istanbul is in the middle of a renaissance of its own. Monocle Films visits the historic city to witness its contemporary metamorphosis.
Battles over the projected identity of Turkey on the landmarks of the city translate into protest. While disagreement over the future exists, pride in the changes is not in short supply.
Istanbul Inspired, a film about change in an ever-changing city on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're travelling to take the temperature of Toronto's tunes. Beatmakers Gil Masuda and Nick Timar have been creating subtly sophisticated hip-hop-tinged tracks from their home city as production duo Circle Research for over a decade. Now they're stepping out from behind the mixing desk to sing on their own tracks as pop project The Precious Lows. Masuda stopped by Midori House recently to talk about the Toronto music scene and share some of its tracks with Monocle's Tom, the Hitman. Hall.
Toronto is mostly known for its indie rock exports, Broken Social Scene, Feist, Peaches, but a lot of people don't know that there's a really great burgeoning scene right now coming out of Toronto, which is sort of more on an electro soul tip and an instrumental beat tip. So I just came here today to maybe play a few tracks and talk about that. It's a really exciting time right now in Toronto, and it's great to be a part of it.
So with no further ado, I mean, what's the first tune that we're going to be hearing today?
So the first tune I picked is from an artist called Maley Todd, a great singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and a good friend of mine, actually. She has a new album out. It's called Escapeology on Do Right Music. So this is my favorite song off the album, and it's called I Can't Stand It.
Selfish heart by the stand it, you know I won't stand it. What you gonna do when they break your back? I can't stand it, you know I won't stand it.
So that was Maley Todd with I Can't Stand It. And I mean, I did a little bit of research myself. That's quite I don't have to research how it sounds. That's quite a smooth kind of
smooth.
It's got a kind of almost a disco feel to it. I heard of a couple of her other tracks which are quite disco influenced.
While she was writing this album, she was listening to a lot of 80s electro, boogie, disco, artists like Evelyn Champagne King and Tana Gardner, things like that. So it was very much influenced, as you can hear in the sound, by what she was listening to at the time. And even we had been introducing her to new artists and stuff that she hadn't heard before. And she really just kind of grabbed a hold of that sound and made it her own.
And what are your thoughts on sort of translating disco to a new audience? Because everyone loves disco. Everyone does love it. But because so much of it is actually very smooth and serene, mm-hmm. there's always like the chance that it can almost become a little bit innocuous, you know, like a sort of lift music sound. You know, I should definitely point out that Maley's music is not falling into that trap. And that's kind of the art, I think, of sometimes producing those records, like producing something really smooth, but that, you know, is going to take someone somewhere, as opposed to leave them feeling kind of just left behind, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. I mean, well, you say that everyone loves disco, but actually for a long time there was a stigma attached to disco, the whole disco sucks thing. But that was when disco became too mainstream. But if you dig a little deeper, you're going to find records that are just amazing and not as poppy or mainstream, but just great music.
So, okay, that's Maley Todd. Should we move on to the next tune? Who have we got next?
So the next artist is Bird, full name Zarin Bird, also a good friend of mine from Toronto. And he has a new album coming out in July, called La Note. He had a music video on Vimeo for a few years now, I think, and it's got up to 159,000 views, and it became a Vimeo staff pick. So he's also just a brilliant director and cinematographer. He did it all himself. So the song that I want to play is called The Whole World Knows. It's also featured on a great compilation called Around Sounds, which features a lot of Canadian artists that are sort of on the cusp of doing good things. So this is called The Whole World Knows.
I said, oh,
that was Bird with The Whole World Knows. That was an extremely chilled out bit of music, wasn't it?
I love chilled out music personally. So that song is one of my favorite songs off that compilation.
Yeah, and we were just discussing while it was playing there that a little bit of a touch of the Toro et moi kind of
definitely
sound.
Definitely, yeah.
And is there a lot of that around Toronto? As you say, I mean, there's this, people know the Buck 65s and the Feists and the Peaches and stuff like that. I mean, is there a lot of that kind of quite club kind of sound bubbling under?
Absolutely, to an extent, because nowadays with the internet and blogs, you can basically get exposed to something at the touch of a button. But in terms of getting play in the clubs, like, you won't hear Toro et moi or any kind of chill wave stuff in the clubs at this point. But there's definitely a group of people that are checking for that kind of music.
And we can't talk about Toronto without talking about the music that you make yourself.
I mean, absolutely.
Do you want to give people a little primer on, because, I mean, you've been doing this a long time. Like, how did you start out and where are you right now?
Okay, well, we started out with Circle Research, me and my partner Nick Timar. And we've been partners for 20 years now. and we've been releasing music since 1996. So through Circle Research, we had a radio show on Ryerson University. We did that for 10 years, and so we got a bit of a name in the Toronto hip-hop community.
So, and your latest project is The Precious Lows.
So The Precious Lows is our new project. We've been working on this for 3 years, and we decided to change the name because Circle Research is more known as being DJs and producers, and we've produced for other artists and done remixes for a bunch of local artists, Ivana Santilli, Elizabeth Shepherd. We've worked with Apostle of Hustle, who are on Arts and Crafts, did a remix for them. So we thought, now that we are doing most of the vocals on top of our beats and doing the songwriting, we should probably change the name because it's a new sound. It's a whole new thing. We wanted to separate this new project from what we've done in the past, because this is probably the most personal project that we've had to date. Because now, not only we're making the music, but we're writing the words and doing the singing. So we changed the name to The Precious Lows, which is kind of a double meaning. You know, it's the low end in the music, the bass, it's so important to make you feel the grooves. But at the same time, there's the precious lows in life. You have your highs and your lows, and you need those lows in order to appreciate the highs.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, I think we should check some of that out. I mean, what tune are we going to hear last?
So we're going to hear a brand new song. Actually, my mastering engineer just emailed this to me 2 days ago.
This is an M24 exclusive.
It's a world premiere. I've only heard it like once or twice on my iPod, so make sure you blast it nice and loud, okay, Alex? This song is called More Than Friends, and it features Maylee Todd.
So now I've just got to know.
Still to come in part two, we'll find out what's behind this week's fantastic session from Gentry. We'll ask whether Hey Beirut is looking at the Middle East through the right prism. And we'll ponder the meaning of life itself as we look ahead to the world's largest philosophy festival. It's not just fun and games here, but it's definitely interesting. It's culture, it's on Monocle 24, and it's with me, Robert Bound. So back to the music, first of all, and the second of the three tracks we'll enjoy from this week's session. Cue Rob Gentry with I Don't Want You.
Just too short. Do you remember that? Now 1 minute more is one too long. Or I could be so kind and say how great it was. That would just be blind. You know I feel no loss. And you can say what you want. Now I'm better than you. Take what you want. I'm no longer your fool. What I do, because I don't want you near me. I long for the time when I didn't know your name. Days were so much brighter than for me. I had no idea of the flame within the flame. Maybe never will I light that again. But the benefit of hindsight is a marvelous thing. If only it had been available back then.
And you can
say what you want. Now I'm better than you. Take what you want. I'm no longer your fool. Watch me do what I do. I don't want you, not for you.
how much you think of me. Not for you to give all your apologies. Never for them to give you sympathy. If you want some words for your philosophy.
Rob Gentry from Gentry, welcome to the Culture Show.
Thank you.
It was a wonderful Midori House session. You were a virtuoso piano genius. We were talking about Chilly Gonzalez, who did a shout-out for our Monocle Weekly 200th anniversary edition. And he calls himself a self-proclaimed genius. I have a feeling that you hide your light slightly more subtly under a bushel.
Yeah, beneath a bank of synths.
How easy is it to play that stuff? Because that seemed there was a lot of pedal action going on. You've got a lovely Nord keyboard and you've got a Moog thing on the top that you said does nothing, but I bet it does. But there's a lot of gear for you to be messing around with. How on earth do you kind of work your way around that?
I guess I've just been doing it a while.
Yeah.
Since I was a kid, so never really thought about it.
How do you write these tunes? Because they seem like you and your drummer Paul, very tight drummer. It's a really percussive, rhythmic, kind of driving sound. It's got a real amazing rhythm to it. How do you write all the songs yourself? It's your music, but how do you write on your own stuff like that that seems to be quite collaborative, or certainly seems to have so many elements going on in it?
Well, drum machines, well,
yeah,
laptop versions of. Yeah, just set a loop going or... Yeah, just...
You work over it. Because it's kind of like, it seems to me, that sort of virtuoso piano stuff, it seems like it's been born out of a jam session, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, a lot of the tunes just come out of me just sitting down at my laptop and starting something and just kind of playing for hours. And the best tunes are just demos that take half an hour to make. And that would be, you know, bass drums and some guitar bit or some stupid screaming vocal thing. But it will have a vibe to it, and that's normally how the sort of tunes happen.
I think I hear in that wonderful session we heard a bit of blue-eyed soul and funk and sort of power pop as well, some big chords in there and things. What sort of records did you grow up listening to? What were you listening to on the radio?
I grew up listening to a random mixture of, I don't know, Johnny Cash, Patsy Cline, Nat King Cole, Matt Monro. That's just the kind of things that were around. Yeah. Like good music. I mean, it's timeless, isn't it?
A lot of crooning going on there.
Yeah. But then I found all my dad's old cassettes of like Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple and Bowie. Yeah. I love Queen. Yeah, a lot of 70s stuff. Obviously Hendrix.
Yeah.
Kind of want to be the keyboard synth Hendrix.
Well, there's some incendiary playing. I mean, that's the virtuoso element of it. You're getting into quite a moment there playing that stuff. That's, you can't think about it. Presumably it has to be natural.
Yeah, it's just, obviously I don't want to be doing too much of that, because then it's just become some sort of terrible 18-minute jam on my own.
I don't think there's any sense that you're recreating the jazz flute section of Anchorman.
Well, a lot of people like that, so maybe something I should think about in the future, you know.
And finally, you are the songs that we've heard today on the Midori House session, they're heading towards an album, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's an EP out, which people can go and check out.
There's going to be. I'm basically going to release Not Like Me as a tune, as a single, and possibly, I know, I've just been recording some new tunes in New York. I've got this stupid cover that I've done as well I might put out on YouTube. Yeah, this thing.
Tell us about the stupid cover. Everyone loves a stupid cover.
I kind of want to keep it a secret.
Okay.
But let me just say 90s R&B.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm hopefully going to blow people's minds.
Is it the return of the Mac?
I don't have the jacket for that. I don't know. So.
He never gave it back, did he?
No.
That was Rob Gentry, who will soon be on a plane to Sydney to play the Opera House. Just a small gig then. To find out more, head to thisisgentry.com and you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, if you ask a person in the street where the worst place in the world might be to be a writer, chances are the words Middle East might come up fairly often. Rights that artists take for granted elsewhere in Europe, for example, are not assured in many Arab countries. This year's Beirut Hay Festival, one of several global editions of the renowned English literary event, tackled this issue head on. But have they got it right? Venetia Rainey went to find out more.
In a leafy garden in East Beirut, set back from the city's frenetic streets, a barrister, a historian, and a writer are discussing whether freedom of expression is a universal right. Sat on chairs underneath a row of palm trees, the audience is paying rapt attention to the lively debate. Even long after dusk has fallen, many remain to pick the speakers' minds. The talk is part of Lebanon's Hay Festival, a bringing together of voices from throughout the Middle East and beyond to discuss everything from literature to women's rights. One of the main themes is freedom of expression. The question of what liberties people in the Middle East and North Africa have is so often in the news these days, it's little wonder people from outside the region think it's the biggest issue facing the Arab world. But is it fair that freedom of expression is one of the main topics we feel we need to address when considering culture from the region?
Well, I think freedom of expression, or the notion of speaking, is the central issue. Speaking in a family, how the kids speak to the parents, how the parents speak to the kids. Speaking in a society, who can speak, who can't speak, position of minorities and so on. And the most important issue of all, speaking to yourself. What you can and can't say to yourself, as it were. Sort of conversations you can have with yourself. How democratic your mind is and so on. So this issue is not only important here, it's important everywhere and particularly important, as it were, with yourself in terms of self-reflection.
The English writer Hanif Qureshi, author of My Beautiful Laundrette and The Buddha of Suburbia, freedom of expression is something people struggle with all over the world. He says pushing against these restrictions, whether in one's mind or in society, is an indispensable part of the process of creating art. In that sense, freedom of expression with regard to culture is a pertinent issue to address the world over.
I mean, that's one of the things that writers are supposed to do, which is, as it were, to be the avatars of dissent, that the writer says speaks on behalf of other people. In that sense, the writer is sort of devil. The writer creates trouble in the, as it were, the establishment by saying the unsayable on behalf of other people. And then the writer has to bear the consequences. But the writer has, as it were, opened the door for other people. And in that sense, the writer is like a terrorist, as it were, leading the charge, you might say.
The sense of duty to expose the fissures of a society is one shared by many writers. The barriers against which one rails in life are formative, and more often than not come to define an artist's voice. Hiyam Yared labels herself as an Arab female Francophone author. She says she cannot help but write about the situation for Arab women in the Middle East.
First of all, I'm a woman. I come from a place where women have not the same civil rights. And this is something that is always in all my writing, because it's something that is, for me, very outrageous. So I think that this is universal. I mean, if you want to take also today the condition of Western women, I don't think there is no work to do anymore. I think that freedom, the freedom that we gain, is not a freedom on which we can sleep. It's a freedom on which we have to continue to battle for, and we have to be the witnesses of this.
Both Yared and Qureshi agree. Writers have a duty to speak about the reality of the society they live in. Do we as readers not also, therefore, have a duty to understand that reality? Freedom of expression is not just about the big picture human rights problems, however. It is also a linguistic issue. If there are words we feel we cannot use, culture will inevitably be stunted. Shireen Al-Fekki's new book, Sex and the Citadel, looks at intimate life in what she describes as a changing Arab world. Reclaiming freedom of expression with regards to sex, she says, is as much about vocabulary as it is about laws.
One of the difficulties we have about talking about sex in the Arab world is actually to do with language. Today, many people, if they speak another language than Arabic, if they speak French or English or even Hebrew, would rather talk about sex in a foreign language than in their native tongue, because they feel uncomfortable, that there is something wrong about speaking about sex in Arabic. I would say, actually, we're in an interesting time now, because if one looks at what has happened over the past 2 years and the uprisings we have seen, I would say that the only truly revolutionary aspect of the turmoil we have seen is that we now have much greater freedom of expression. The fear of speaking out is gone, so that people now feel much more comfortable, at ease to speak their minds, and more than that, they now feel that it is their right to be heard. When your voice is illegal, only choice for the people is to stand up proudly
in the face of death. It ain't a waste of breath when you speak up loudly on behalf of the kids. In a study released this year, Reporters Without Borders ranked the Middle East and North Africa as the least tolerant region in the whole world for press, a good indicator of freedom of expression in general. The picture appears to look bleak. Heba Moreyef is the Human Rights Watch director for Egypt. She says although there is now a worrying trend of backlash against those speaking their mind, the Arab Spring has created a new cultural landscape.
I think you see that very much in Tunisia and in Libya, because the space for criticism was so limited there, if non-existent. So there was sort of the sudden explosion of music as well in Libya. If you listen to sort of Libyan rap, or it just would have been unthinkable. What I think was one of the biggest differences in the immediate aftermath of the uprising was that people were no longer afraid, to criticize the president, security officials, and even the military. So there was a clear shift in the sense that people's fear levels dropped. And I would never underestimate the impact of that loss of fear and that appropriation of the space to criticize.
While the Arab Spring has seen some new creative liberty blossoming, for many it has only exposed the amount of work still to be done. Major cultural events such as the Hay Festival are an opportunity to celebrate the wonderful diversity of work that comes out of the region. But the context from which these works arise should not, or perhaps cannot, be glossed over. The reality for artists in the Arab world has changed dramatically over the last two tumultuous years, and will continue to do so in the future. This means that, more than ever, freedom of expression and its impact on culture is something we need to be constantly reassessing. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We'll end the show after this with a touch of philosophy. Stay tuned.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we've just got time now to contemplate the meaning of life. Kicking off in Hay on Wye next week is How the Light Gets In, which claims to be the world's largest philosophy and music festival. Spanning everything from psychology to metaphysics, the event features 450 happenings loosely based around this year's theme of error, lies and adventure. And to find out more about the festival and where philosophy sits in modern culture, Monocle's Tom Edwards sat down with event founder and director of the Institute of Art and Ideas, Hilary Lawson.
When I started some 5 years ago, it looked as if this was a ludicrous idea, having a philosophy festival, I think, at the time. I mean, who was going to come? It seemed rather marginal. It's the sort of thing that people told Monty Python jokes about. You know, I don't know whether you know the Monty Python football match with philosophers, which nobody can score a goal. That was sort of like the picture of philosophy. And, of course, one of the things that we're trying to do is to change that image of philosophy, because philosophy is really about the things that we all care about. It's about our lives. I mean, we're all worried about what our lives are about, what the world is about, what we're doing. And it's a rather bizarre Anglo-Saxon phenomenon, really, that philosophy has been marginalised into a strange academic space.
And just in terms then of how it sits in this country, what do you think about this? I mean, is there a problem that Brits maybe specifically have about, you know, debating the big ideas? Are we uncomfortable about asking those difficult questions, do you think?
Yeah, interesting question. I think, of course, you're absolutely right that I think until we got going, I think the perception of philosophy is the sort of thing which we might leave to Parisian taxi drivers, but nothing that is done by somebody who's really rather sensible. And that's because there's a suspicion of it, as well as thinking that it doesn't really lead anywhere. So there has been, I think, a tradition in Britain of being suspicious of what are seen as being rather empty intellectual ideas. It's quite interesting to wonder what is the reason for that. I mean, is it that, you know, our recent past or relatively recent past in sort of long-term history was about, you know, industrial revolution and scientific, practical, technical things, and somehow we therefore value those and we are more sceptical of overall ideas. I don't know what it is, but I think that one of the things that has been really apparent is, first of all, that the How the Light Gets In as an event started as a really tiny event and it's grown at sort of spectacular pace. And I think there are some signs that it is changing the way that people think about philosophy.
And then talk to me about how a festival of philosophy works, because if you're looking at sort of strolling around, just food and drink and music, this sort of entertainment environment, does that actually help, do you think, to sort of shake off some of those shackles? People label philosophy, it's the provenance of academe. Does that help to have that more, is it just a more engaging environment? Does that enable people to engage better with the problems?
Well, absolutely. I think one of the reasons I think that we've been successful is you have to break down both the tedium, really, of the lecture hall and the pretense. There are lots of situations in an academic environment in which no one is really saying anything very much. And we've got to get out of that to a position where people feel that they can converse in a perfectly sensible way about big ideas and in ways that everyone can understand. And we don't in any way dumb down our material. When we started off, we thought, well, actually, maybe, you know, we have to make this more accessible. But we don't do that at all. I mean, if we have a debate about subatomic physics, we talk about subatomic physics. But because of the environment and because the cornerstone of the festival are debates, so that they're not talks or lectures, everybody knows there's going to be somebody there who's going to say, well, what are you talking about? and you just can't get away with stuff that is just arcane and isn't about trying to convince people of some point that you're trying to make.
Okay, let's look then at this year's programme. What are some of the highlights? What are some of the big names? What will be some of these big questions that hopefully you'll be providing answers for?
Well, we've got a really fascinating theme this year, and our theme this year is called Error, Lies and Adventure. You might think, well, what's the connection between error, lies and adventure? Well, the idea is that it is through identifying errors that we find new adventures. If we operate in a space of thinking in which everything is known and you're sure about where everything is going, there's very little opportunity for a new adventure. New adventure comes from finding the cracks in your current framework of thought and then seeing a new way to do things. And this theme runs through all of our debates and talks this year. And so each event will have somebody or some issue that we're identifying as a potential error and examining the adventure that might come from that. So in the case of, if you take a political space, for example, is the idea of the West and the East an error? Is, in fact, the future going to be something more like China versus India? And is the West just a marginal player for some future game? So it's that sort of really big question that we put on the table and then explore what are the consequences of seeing this error, as it were, in our current framework. And we apply that in each of the, so there are similar sort of questions in science. You know, is it possible that there could be a unified theory? Is this actually a mistake? Is the very idea that we might arrive an error? And if it is an error, well, what does that mean about the way we think about the current models and how we might be going?
And just very briefly, Hilary, to close, just tell us about some of the stellar names, if you like, who might be joining the fun to hopefully deliver answers to these questions.
I mean, we've a debate about fantasy, and which is called At the World's Edge. We've got Terry Pratchett, A.S. Byatt, and Terry Eagleton all in the same debate. I think that will be great. In relation to the debate that we were talking about the future of the world in terms of global politics, on the decline and fall of the American Empire, there's Shirley Williams, Will Hutton, Cory Doctorow. There are loads more, but that's just a teaser.
That was Hilary Lawson talking to Tom Edwards, and the Philosophy and Music Festival, How the Light Gets In, starts next Thursday, 23rd of May, in Hay on Wye. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week will be an advertising special. So lots to look forward to there. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher mixed it up. All good. Time for one final song this week from their Midori House session. This is Gentry with Not Like Me. Thanks for tuning in.
Nobody loves you more around here. Nobody loves you more around here. Not like me. Not like me. Some not like me. Hold you dear. They will let you go. Disappears. They're not like me. Not like me. Not like me. Not like me. No. No one loves you more around here.